Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
I'm stoked. Okay.
What are you banging on?
Three, two, my desk. It's a really sturdy desk. Okay, systems in place.
There we go. There, I'm just sitting here waiting for the music. Story of my life. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. Are we allowed to sing along with our own music? Welcome.
Does it have words?
To Make Me Smart.
Make me
the
smart.
The podcast about tech, culture, and the economy in no particular order.
You didn't riff on
Make
on,
me
oh,
smart.
Man. No, that wasn't even the thing, man. You got to go with the melody.
I don't
melody.
Even know what you were singing. I don't know your song.
All right, we're going to sing on the out. I'll sing it on the music on the back end. This week we are talking with Nancy Lublin. She's the founder and CEO of Crisis Text Line.
And I like how you've now been enticed to stay until the end.
I know,
because the
I
man
know,
never
I know.
Sings.
I know, right.
We are... That is going to be such a great conversation with Nancy Lublin, the whole conversation about data and how to use it to have a better conversation. We are also going to hear from one of you, dear listeners, our favorite part of the show, because no one is as smart as all of us, a customs broker who has seen quite a lot of activity from the tariff situation, the little war of words that has been going
on. Don't say that blank for blank word, because I promised people on Twitter the other day I wasn't going to say that, so I'm not saying that.
It's nope,
not,
no chance.
It's not a blank
no
for blank.
No way.
Yes, but before we get there, this.
Okay, did you go on spring break?
Oh, hello. You must be Molly Wood, back from vacation. Because, no, I didn't go on vacation.
I am. That's why I sound so cheerful.
I know.
And relaxed. Because I took because Twitter and Facebook have been off my phone for weeks, and I turned off all my notifications. It was amazing. Also, can I just put a plug in for Catalina Island?
Oh, yeah. It looked amazing, actually. I saw your Insta. It looked incredible.
It was fantastic. I had no idea that that weird little island would be so fun. It's right off of it's right off Southern California.
Yeah.
You fly into Long Beach.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like visiting, it's like Italy, Mexico, Hawaii, and then a little bit of Yellowstone all rolled into one. Because there's like buffalo and like a beach and it looks like Lake Como. And it's just, it's crazy. It was really cool.
And now you're gonna swamp it with tourists because you're giving it such a ringing endorsement.
I know.
Thanks for wrecking
I
it.
I wondered about that.
Thanks for wrecking it.
Mind, everyone. You don't want to go there.
That's not why people are here.
People are here to hear us talk about the actual news. Thank God I'm back for this week, in which Mark Zuckerberg heads to Washington to testify in front of two committees. He's doing it probably right as you were. He's already done one day as you're hearing this.
Yep.
The next day is going to be tomorrow. So we're not going to talk too much about that, but I do want to give a little plug for our coverage on Marketplace Tech.
Yeah.
We're doing a whole series this week because ultimately, look, this story is just about data and privacy. It's not, you know, it's only about Facebook in that Facebook is the biggest name in the news today. But it's about the data economy and whether we're at a tipping point there.
Is it not also about corporate hubris and Silicon Valley as a culture unto itself and regulatory ineptitude on the part of our national leadership? And I mean, it's only like a half hour podcast. I could go on. Should I go on?
I know. Well, that's yes, please. Like, that's all the stuff we get to hear.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's my point.
And it is. Yeah,
I mean, I get that it's data and privacy, but there's so much encapsulated in this story. I guess that's what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. It is all of the hubris that assumes that, you know, in the Zuckerberg case, and this is what's going to be so fascinating about the testimony, and I feel like I'm such at a disadvantage because you will have all seen some of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this guy, the way that he talks about them, look, it cannot be overstated that Mark Zuckerberg is fundamentally an ideologue.
Wow.
And
interesting turn of phrase.
And a super capitalist. You know, he's got this mission. He's had this mission all along. And the mission is to force people to connect themselves to everybody else in the world, but not him. and that he could make a ton of money off of it.
Yeah.
He's the only guy in charge of Facebook. So yeah, that's where you get all the Silicon Valley stuff and the hubris and all of that.
I'm going to say something
here.
Go ahead.
No, I'm going to let you talk.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm going to say something here that's going to make the three producer heads on the other side of the control room glass here, it's going to make their heads explode. But I'm going to say this, and we're going to see what they say. I think on Thursday morning LA time, you and I should sit down in a studio and do 15 minutes of free association on the Zuckerberg hearing and just put it in the feed.
Oh.
What do you think?
Okay.
You know what I like to call
that? And dear everyone.
Yeah, I like to call that being a full-service host. I can host and produce and think on my feet the whole time.
Right? Look at him go. And then before, if you would like that to happen and you don't want our producers to put the kibosh on us, you could totally email us and tweet us.
And you could shame them into it. And we could go rogue.
They're going to be like, whoa, whoa. Don't y'all have jobs? No, I think that is a great idea.
Honestly,
I think that's an outstanding idea.
And honestly, just
I'll
like,
be...
Yeah, 15 minutes, concentrate the mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I love that plan. Right,
there we go.
Are they nodding? Kai's the only one in the office.
Yes, there are three people nodding.
Outstanding.
And Daniel, the
Are there thumbs
going,
up? Are they sweating? Zuckerberg
they're
style?
Not sweating. They're,
anyway.
There are six thumbs up, and Daniel is sitting at the control panel going, what, man? I don't have time for this.
That is a great plan, because then we don't have to use up all our thoughts today.
So that's what we're going to do with Zuckerberg, okay? So here's the deal. All y'all, read the coverage, pay attention to the hearings as you can, and then send us your thoughts on Twitter. She's at Molly Wood. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. And we will hash this out on Thursday morning.
Okay. Right? It's a plan.
Does that make sense? All right. Good.
Boom. Putting it in my calendar now.
All right.
Type.
Really? Type? No.
No, I don't know. I was going to... like a verbal sound effect? Is that not a radio
Do you
thing?
Not have a keyboard in front of you? Wait, it goes like this.
Okay. I do.
There we go. Oh, look, wait. And okay.
But look, Google Doc.
I just did that in a Slack channel and somebody just got a really weird Slack. Oh my God, that's really funny.
I think I just erased a bunch of stuff
I now
in
have
rundown.
To write, never mind. Okay. All right. So anyway, so now we've got that done. oh my God, now I want to actually send. Here we go. Wow, that's so funny.
I don't know, this is real time, everyone. Real time podcasting, high quality content. And Kai broke Slack. Other things that are happening. We are going to talk about the economy, though.
We are.
We are moving on to basically a front row seat to trade from one of our listeners. When this show is working the best and firing on all cylinders, it's when everybody is participating in the smart making. And this is going to be one of those cases.
Yeah. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to back you up a little bit and we're going to go back to early March and the Trump, what have now come to be called the Trump steel tariffs, right? He put $50 billion of tariffs on China for a bunch of stuff. We've got the steel tariffs on global steel importers. There's all kinds of tariff news in the news. Here's why we're telling you that. We have a listener to this podcast whose name is Gretchen Blau. She works as a customs broker in Erie, Pennsylvania. Now, that's interesting and cool because I was in Erie, Pennsylvania several times over the past year talking about the 2016 election and a bunch of other stuff. And she heard it. She's a Make Me Smart listener. And she emailed us and told us about her job. She does like imports and exports with a company called Logistics Plus. I just want to play it a little bit and some tape from her. And here's her job as she describes it.
What I do is I classify all the commodities that come in for our company. There's a system called the Harmonized Tariff System, and there are 98 chapters to that. They're probably like, I'm going to say 2 feet thick.
Man.
And
Nightmare.
I have to, you know, list the values, the weights, the classifications, the descriptions and whatnot.
Oh my God. Okay. See, I love this stuff where it's just, you have no, it's how the, it's all happening. Like,
right.
Does the tariff system, the 2 foot thick book have to just change every time there's a,
I think
spat?
It does. I think that's the rule.
Yeah.
I think that's the rule.
So, and then after she lists all the values and does all this paperwork, then she checks each order against, and this is where probably all those constant changes would come in, all the regulatory codes from the EPA, the FDA, the FCC, the Department of Agriculture, and then she submits it all to Customs for approval.
And when all this tariff news broke, those from China and who's going to have the tariffs and this and that and $100 billion there, we called her up and we said, what the what?
A lot of confusion, it seems like. We still have a lot of customers that are trying to figure out how to deal with this, whether it's by changing their sourcing or changing what they import. So they're kind of scrambling for solutions at the moment. And
couple of customers already that basically came back to us and said, hey, can you review our HTS codes and kind of bump that up against the list that's been released of potential duty increases and tell us where we stand? So that's been a challenge to the day. Let's put it that way.
So nobody knows.
Yeah.
HTS, she mentioned, is the Harmonized Tariff Schedule codes. I can't even imagine. So she told us that the phones are very busy. A lot of clients are actually increasing their orders. They're trying to get shipments in ahead of the latest tariffs, like all those people trying to prepay their property taxes before tax cuts went into effect. Others are trying to plan for the long term.
So she said duty increases. By the way, let's remember that duty is another word for tariff, which is basically extra money that companies have to pay to get their goods into any given country. And Gretchen told us that after the steel tariffs were levied, because let's remember, right, the steel tariffs are actually in effect. All these other ones between the U.S. and China, the bilateral tariffs, they are not yet actually in effect. But after the steel tariffs went into effect, one of her clients started looking for a place, a country, where they could park their steel shipment without paying any duties, without paying any import taxes, instead of sending it all here. And if you think about the trickle-down effects of what that means in terms of steel imports to this country and whether suppliers can get stuff, it's a big deal. Here you go.
Which means that they could leave it until they got the opportunity to pull those items out and use them gradually so they didn't have to pay all the duty all at once. Or they could export it without having paid duty in the U.S. And they were sourcing from the EU. And at the last minute, the EU was exempt from the tariffs.
Surprise.
Huh.
Yeah.
So this is like parking your money. This is like Apple parking its money overseas to not have to pay taxes. And except that in this case, it's not money. It's literally steel.
Well, yeah, kind of. But let me just delve into the policy here for a minute, right? We know that the Trump administration makes policy almost literally willy-nilly, right? I mean, the president can wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, reach for his phone, and implement a national economic policy of one way or the other. And that has happened repeatedly over the past, where are we now, like 15, 16 months. And so what's happening is there's no chance for suppliers, corporations in this country, consumers, providers of raw materials, there's no chance for them to plan on any of these things. So literally ships were in the middle of the ocean trying to figure out what to do with this, you know, cargo full of $3 million worth of steel. I don't even know. And that's just in a lot of ways bananas. And here's some more Gretchen along those lines.
So they didn't get a whole heck of a lot of warning, some of them. And some of their stuff was on the water, and they found out that there was going to be an extra 25% for steel or 10% for aluminum, and there was nothing they could really do about it except ship it back. And in a lot of cases, that would cost just as much.
So there are long-term contracts. Yeah, there are long-term contracts involved here. There is, as I said, literally millions of dollars on the line. It's not yet quite clear who's going to wind up paying for the tariffs, for the extra shipping charges, for any of that stuff, except for one thing, and that is this, what Gretchen's about to say.
It's entirely possible that all of it gets passed on to the consumer, you know, the everyday consumer that's just going down to the big box store to pick something up for their families.
Well, of course it is.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's more than entirely possible. It is 100% likely, right?
A certainty, yeah. And these are the tariffs, we should point out, that were announced essentially overnight, and even the president's National Economic Advisor didn't know about it.
Yeah.
And this is so we are examining the real time effects of that in basically real time.
Yep.
After we talked to Gretchen, the White House then went on to propose $100 billion more in various tariffs. She wrote to us again and described a customer who wanted to import some machines from China so he could make more products in the U.S. The answer that she gave him on whether those machines would face a tariff was, quote, maybe.
Yeah, I'm just going to say
it's a hot mess.
This is a bananas way to make economic policy. And let's be clear here, right? I mean, there are some parts of this where President Trump is right. The Chinese have been stealing intellectual property and forcing technology transfer. And the domestic steel industry has been handicapped by a glut of steel on the international market. I think the real thing to take away from this, though, is that willy-nilly economic policymaking is no way to make economic policy, if that makes any sense. That's my considered opinion.
What the president has said, and I'm kind of curious on your thoughts, is yes, it is going to hurt in the short term.
Yeah.
And change is hard, and we will be stronger as a result. Do you buy any of that?
Well, yes, all three of those things are true. But here's the deal. There was a mechanism in place. And let's deal specifically with China, right? And what's really interesting is you see his new National Economic Council director, Larry Kudlow, coming in and saying a lot of what I'm about to say here. Kudlow talks about a coalition of the willing against the Chinese. We had a coalition of the willing against the Chinese. It was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was 11 Asian-Pacific countries getting into a trade agreement with each other to counter Chinese influence in the region and make China come along with globally accepted rules on trade. Instead, what has happened is the president has pulled us out of those multilateral agreements. NAFTA also is on the table here as something that could be done away with. And he is now trying to go it alone in a much more confrontational and in some ways zero-sum game. And I say zero-sum intentionally because trade wars is a phrase that's being bandied about much too much lately. But it certainly looks like, and I should say here that there's been some movement by President Xi of China to sort of talk things down a little bit and maybe start some negotiations. But until this morning, Tuesday, it seemed that there was a trade war in the offing. And that's nobody wins a trade war. And the idea that making willy-nilly economic policy and starting a trade war at the same time is somehow going to be advantageous to anybody in this country, I don't get.
Yeah. Did China blink, though? I mean, that did happen.
Well, yeah. So look, here,
right before we sort of came on the air today.
It totally did. So President Xi made a big, long speech at a regional summit meeting in Asia on Monday night, Tuesday morning, L.A. time, in which he said, listen, we're going to reduce tariffs on Chinese imports of automobiles into China, and we're going to open up the rest of the economy. That's great. And maybe it will provide some room for negotiation. But if it's true that he intends to do this, and he said these kinds of things before, it will be years, first of all. And also, the benefit is not necessarily as much as it might appear. For example, this idea that President Xi is going to lower import duties on American cars into China is all well and good, but it's basically meaningless because most of the American cars that are sold in China are made in China. Buicks and General Motors and lots of other plants exist in China employing Chinese workers. I've been there. You could be in Detroit for this Shanghai-based GM plant that I was in probably 6 or 8 years ago. So it's a lot of really nice talk, but without a lot of substantive action.
Thank God Kai is here. Seriously.
Well, you know, we're doing you on Thursday, on Facebook. I'm just going to sit back and ask questions.
See, this is why it all works, everybody. We are, in our next part of the show, going to essentially have a conversation about how some of these conversations could have gone better and how they might go better in the future. But like Gretchen, please let us know what you know all about. Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Be our on-air expert. You can leave us a comment at our website, makemesmart.org. And of course, you can tweet us at Kai Rizdahl and at Molly Wood. A little music and time to pay the bills. We're back. We're going to switch gears.
What's really funny is the rundown says, we back.
We back.
I'm
me.
Not Ron Burgundy.
We're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about data as a lightsaber. Yes, it can be used for either good or not. Yeah, come on. Remember? You do, when you hear it, you're going to remember.
I do remember. I'm just trying to minimize it so nobody makes fun of me. I'm just saying.
Except me, apparently.
Yeah. Well, and everybody else listening to this podcast. We talked.
Taking a hit for the team again.
We talked to Nancy Lublin, who's done a whole lot of successful nonprofits in her life. Most recently, she's the founder and CEO of something called the Crisis Text Line, which gives people emergency counseling anonymously through text messaging, which is kind of a cool idea. And with all that data, right, she's got tens of millions of text messages as data. She started a for-profit arm of that company called Loris AI.
We sat down with Nancy and she told us that Crisis Text Line was a spinoff itself of DoSomething.org, which was a platform she created that gave young people a different way to sort of connect with causes they care about. They could volunteer, they could collect items to donate, almost like a GoFundMe. And of course, it used a lot of text messaging to organize those campaigns. And then in the course of sending out those texts to all these millions of people, Nancy Lublin and her team started getting these messages back. And very often they were not about causes. They were about serious problems in some of these kids' lives.
Kids started texting us terrible things that were going on in their lives, like about being bullied or about domestic violence situations. And I was like, look, if they're going to share by text, maybe there ought to be a hotline by text. And so we built it and launched. It took about 2 years to launch, but we launched it.
How do you teach people how to respond to a text that says something horrible like that?
Right. Mostly it's suicide and depression, a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety, a lot of self-harm actually is way bigger than I thought it was. And so we respond with crisis counselors who are volunteers, who apply online, go through a background check and about a 30-ish hour training that includes quizzes and role plays on your computer. You can do it at home in your jammies. And you're equipped to handle these conversations. It's pretty amazing. Originally, we also thought that it would be like we'd match women with women or LGBTQ texters with LGBTQ crisis counselors or Texas with Texas. And we tested all of that and none of it matters. What actually matters is speed and the wait times and how quickly we can get a human talking to you.
The drawback with texting, and we've seen this in our personal lives, right? Not in our face-to-face relationships, but the drawback with texting is the potential for misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but it turns out texting is awesome for this. Yeah, you don't
really
get tone. That's right. Like my tone here. Yeah, you don't get that by text, but you don't get judgments. And you don't have anybody eavesdropping. So we spike every day at lunchtime because people will text us from lunch in a school cafeteria or at Subway or wherever. And you think they're texting their mom. They're actually texting us. And you don't have to wait until later in the day when there's a quiet time. You can text us in the heat of the moment, which means we can have the maximum impact. We can get you right as you're deciding whether or not to swallow a pill or have a panic attack or respond with anger. We can get you right in that hot moment and help you make a safe and healthy decision.
Hmm. This is going to sound a little trivial, but I think having heard you speak once before that it's not. How important are kind of all of the trappings that we've added to texting to make it more emotional, like emojis?
So funny. We do get some emojis, and different emojis mean different things. We are blocking photos and videos because we think that would, frankly, be too triggering for our crisis counselors to see some of these images. You can actually get a lot just from words, from pacing. What's nice about text is because it's private and anonymous, people spill their guts to us by the third message. 65% of people tell us they've shared something with us they've never told another human being.
Wow.
So it feels safe. Nobody knows whether you're young or old or male or female or transgendered. No one knows any of those things. There are no judgments.
Do the people who have texted you in moments of crisis know that you're capturing their data?
Absolutely. That's all mentioned there in the Terms of Service and Privacy Policy. We actually, in the Terms of Service and Privacy Policy, we wrote those things so that people could actually read them.
Where does that, do they get that right back from the first?
Yeah, the first text.
The first thing
what's
we give
crisis
you. What's
your crisis and can
text.
You fill out our privacy policy?
No. Not can you fill it out. And here's our Terms of Service. It's the first thing we give you is a link to the Terms of Service.
All right.
So that you can see exactly what we're doing. And actually, you can look at the public data. It's at Crisis Trends, and that's been there since we launched, crisistrends.org. And we've actually heard from a number of people that they're glad that we've shared that because it's made the world understand their pain more.
Mm-hmm. So, from this conversation so far, it's clear you have a lot of information. You have a lot of texts back and forth between volunteers and people in crisis. And now you're spinning off this startup, this pretty newly announced Loris AI, to use that data in a more useful way. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So my goal is to make a more empathetic world. My goal is not just to make a really great not-for-profit. My goal is to make people happier and healthier. And there are lots of ways to do that. At Crisis Textline, we do it with crisis intervention. But yeah, we've amassed 63 million plus messages back and forth in just over 4 years. And so we've learned a ton We've learned a ton to make us as an organization faster and better, but we've also learned a ton about human behavior and what kinds of words are really hot and what kind of words help. So, for example, with anxiety, we've learned that the top word people use is overwhelmed. And do you want to take a guess what the counterweight to overwhelmed is? What's the best word that we've found that helps you when you're feeling overwhelmed?
Knitting.
Avocado toast?
No. Avocado toast, yeah.
It's strong. So the word is strong. So countering overwhelmed, most people will guess content, happy. They guess a counter feeling. But actually, strong isn't just a feeling. It's a capability. So it helps you help yourself.
Okay. So what are you going to do with that knowledge, right? You've got all these gazillions of texts. You know prompt and response, as it were. Here now you have Loris AI. What are you going to do with it to make the world a more, what was it, feeling place?
Empathetic place.
Yeah. So we started hearing from companies saying, gosh, you've trained all these crisis counselors. You know, you have the data to know what works for cultural competency and empathy and compassion. Can you teach our employees? And I was like, well, that is not what a not-for-profit is supposed to do. We're here for the public benefit. But gosh, would you pay us? And so we launched a company. We were taking nominations from companies who are genuinely committed to creating empathy in their workplace and with their customers, who are committed to cultural competency. And then we're going to train their employees to be better humans.
All right. So I come to see you. I run the Acme Widget Company. And I say, Nancy, I really care about making my company and my people more empathetic. Can you help me make more money for my company? You good with that?
Well, maybe. I mean, first we're going to screen you and see whether or not you genuinely are committed. Somebody who comes and says, can you help me make more money for our company, might not be as committed to some of these principles that we're talking about, which is really, again, cultural competency. We want to make sure that some of these Me Too incidents that happen in workplaces don't happen anymore. Wait, we want to make sure that...
Doesn't it feel like it would be better to go to the companies that have had Me Too incidents? Or I mean, it sounds like you're creating an interview process, but everybody needs this, right?
100%. And so, like, I mean, yes. And companies like, I mean, I'm kind of hoping to hear from United, right? How many more passengers need to be reaccommodated before they realize that they need a little bit of our help? And there's a whole bunch of companies who I hope, it's not whether or not you're good at this. It's whether or not you're genuinely committed to doing this better. So if they just came to us and said, please help us make more money, you could pay Loris to do that, but those are not the first companies we're going to take into the beta.
Once upon a time, around 2015 or so, you were asked about this by a hedge fund manager. You know, would you let me buy this data? And you said, you know, I you're a jerk. Is how and
actually, I used a stronger word than that, but yes.
All righty, not to the New Yorker, which good on you, very profesh. Yeah. What tipped you over into saying, okay, this is something that can be a for-profit product?
So we're still not selling the data, and I still wouldn't do that. And we are, I'm a mama bear with her cub protecting the personally identifiable information. So there is no PII that gets shared anywhere, not even with our own crisis counselors. We don't share the PII when we give them feedback. What we're using the data for a subsidiary company that Crisis Text Line is the majority shareholder in. So Crisis Text Line owns. And what we're doing is leveraging the learnings. So none of these companies will see the actual data. They're not getting this in raw form. We're just going to use the learnings to help train people to be better people.
What's the potential for civic society from the data that you have?
I will tell you that Congress has been nominated to go through this training.
Did Congress?
And what are you going to do?
Congress nominate itself? Because that seems unlikely.
I think it was a congressional aide. And I think it's a terrific idea. If you think about those aides, not only do they have to deal with the red and blue infighting, but also constituents who are in pain over a host of issues. And most of those communications, I mean, some of them are by phone, but most of them are also by email and other forms of communication. And we can be really helpful, again, to take these hot moments to cool comms and make people more productive in their communications so that it's less about the emotion and more about the connection.
Choose Congress, Nancy. Choose Congress.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I know. I hope so.
I think the whole texting thing is fascinating and this whole I just think it's so interesting. And the data capture is
fascinating
as well.
But. I mean... everything comes down to the data on some level. But I do think this is the, you know, the reason that we were so interested in this conversation was because we're trying to, on this podcast, explore ways to reboot compromise. But we're also, and I think it's also fair to point out that there can be good uses of data. This is still a lot of data collection, and, you know, that can't be overstated. But if we can, like, the promise of big data and the promise of artificial intelligence all along was it can come up with these insights, right? The kinds of insights that say that if you use strong in response to overwhelmed, you could actually have a positive outcome. And if that can improve discourse, then great, right? then text away.
Oh, but the temptations of commerce.
Well,
I
know.
Saying.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, it's really, and I think Nancy clearly feels that.
Yep.
Like, she has gone from a place of pure helping people to, like, the dark side.
All right, over to y'all, as always, hearing from you what you're seeing out in the world and, more importantly, wondering about.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
Hi, Al Groves from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I wanted to say a little bit about...
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
That's a new sting, people. A slightly related,
it's
but
new.
You know, new thing.
But new thing.
Yeah.
After our interview with Nancy Lublin, we actually shared a couple of listener questions with her, a couple of your questions. One of those came from Chris Verner in North Carolina, who asked, I think the question we all want to know, please help me understand the algorithms. He said, I lived for decades in blissful ignorance of these things. Now they seem to be infiltrating every crack and crevice of my life, influencing everything from the online ads I see. Little did you know when you sent us this question, Chris, so many months ago, to my Facebook feeds and the balance in my retirement accounts.
Oh, snap. So we're going to hear from Nancy again real quick because we actually did ask her, are algorithms the thing that are going to destroy us or perhaps save us?
I think of all technology like a lightsaber, and it can either be red or blue. Technology itself, I think of as largely neutral, and it depends on
the
person.
Okay, wait. What's the difference between a red and a blue lightsaber?
Kai.
I love Nancy.
I watched all the Star Wars movies. Come on. What?
Really? Well, then you should know the blue ones are the good guys, and the red ones have
joined the dark side. Who's paying attention to a lightsaber when there's a lightsaber battle going on? Why do you care what color it is?
We just got 100 more emails.
Okay. And you really did. You really did.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, so let me give you an example, because this is my favorite nerdy example of algorithms being used for good, for the force. So when we first built Crisis Text Line, we put in a few words, die, suicide, overdose. And if texters used those words, we made them number one in the queue because we should stack rank based on severity, right? And so that worked pretty well for a while. And then some people started to game the system. And we also added on a machine learning algorithm that looked at words and word combinations, because it's not like I'm suicidal. The word suicide appears there, but they said I'm not suicidal. So, right, that's not really high risk. So we looked at sentence structure, all that stuff, and we found thousands of words and word combinations that are actually more lethal, more dangerous than the word suicide. We even found that the word CVS is twice as likely for us to call 911 than the word suicide, because you either got your pills at CVS or you're going there to get them. I mean, it's really, so we found all this data, and then we put these words and word combinations back into our algorithm, and now we're that much faster and that much more accurate. So thank you from North Carolina. You are right. This stuff can be used for good or evil, and I'm trying to wield this to make the world better.
I'm just going to go ahead and stand by my lightsaber ignorance. Come at me. Go ahead.
That's legit my favorite part.
There you go.
All right. We have more questions and answers from you. We got a question from listener Nell Stamper in Astoria, Oregon, who speaks directly to me. To me.
Hi, Molly and Kai. I'm part of a group of veterans and service-minded people working in a tech startup to provide a cooperative social media experience that's much better and safer for users. I'm lucky enough to be working on equity, diversity, and inclusion for this new company, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions for companies that have set their founders' culture in a positive way. I'd love to get some guidance on what to read or who to listen to as we move forward with this. Also, I live in Astoria, Oregon, and I love the bit about the Columbia Bar pilots that you did. Molly, if you ever come back here, please let us know. We'd love to have you give a talk at one of our local brew pubs.
Well, there you go. That's Dude. A good deal, right?
I feel like actually really Kai should be the one talking at brew pubs, I'm into it.
You know,
I'm into it.
You can come along.
I'm going to punt a tiny bit on this because we put that question to Nancy Lublin.
Yeah, we totally did. She wrote back that she's been inspired by Anil Dash. He's a tech blogger, software CEO as well. And here's her quote about him. He quietly spent the year only following, retweeting, and magnifying women's voices on Twitter. He never made a thing about it. He just did it. And she says it was a powerful way to use that platform with intention about inclusion, which is kind of cool, actually, if you think about it.
Yeah, I could not agree more about Anil Dash, actually. He is wonderful. A-N-I-L Dash, if you don't already follow him. He's outstanding. And then as to that idea of, you know, companies that set their founders' culture, I think that's we're trying to find those companies all the time on Marketplace Tech, and I will have better answers for you as we go along. You had a lot of questions about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. No surprise. Nancy Perry in Alaska left us this voicemail.
Hi, this is Nancy in Anchorage. And I've been listening to all the coverage about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. And what I want to know is why is this getting so much more attention than the Equifax data theft? Isn't the Equifax breach much more dangerous to many more people?
So different kinds of information, right? But also there's the scale on the whole. It's the insidiousness.
I mean, the scale is essentially the same. The reason that this is different is that when you have a data breach, it's been really hard to get people's attention, right? I talked to, like, one expert just said to me, it's because there's no blood. Like, when there's a data breach, there's no blood.
Yeah.
You don't feel the effects until years later. But I think that what a lot of people are feeling is that there were these extraordinary upheavals in 2016, globally. Not just the 2016 election, but there was, right? Like, the polls did not have Donald Trump winning. There was the Brexit vote. There was kind of this, like, revolution that a lot of people felt like they didn't see coming, and they are trying to find reasons for some of those events. And this Facebook thing feels like the reason. Like, we all knew that social media was influencing us in ways I think we were not totally cognizant of. And this feels like the blood, I think, for a lot of people.
I buy that.
It's not totally abstract.
That. Yep.
That's my theory. I-10 Hershkovitz. Says being a 20-year-old gives him a very, hopefully that was right, says being 20 gives him a totally different perspective on the Facebook Cambridge Analytica issue.
Hi, Kai and Molly. As a young person, I've come to the conclusion that the only way I can live my life is to be vigilant about my data. Trust, but verify. Trust a company when it takes my data, but verify that it secures it properly. I've always known that Facebook's business model was essentially selling personal data. The problem I have with Facebook is not that they take my data, but that they give it away so liberally.
Yeah, no joke. Dovier, no provier, if I can get all Reagan-esque on you here, right? Trust, but verify.
Ooh.
I know, right? I'm just giving away how old I am. I don't even know what to say.
I was like, 20, huh?
Yeah. Ronald Reagan.
Different perspective on a lot of things.
Yeah.
But you know what, though? Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Like, thank goodness that is the takeaway. Because honestly, it will only be, and this is why we did a whole episode, the make me care situation.
Yep.
Only when people care and ask their companies to behave better will they. Because we are not, we're not getting regulation in the U.S. So
Congress,
and
Molly,
like
and
you.
Mark Zuckerberg, they're talking to him, and surely there's going to be regulation. Isn't there, Molly? Please, please tell me there's going to be, please.
Yes, it's called the GDPR. It's coming from Europe.
Oh, yeah, there we go again. All right. Not to scoff at that, but the idea that we're actually going to have that kind of regulation.
Drink.
Yeah, anyway, so we're going to wrap it up with a Make Me Smart question, and it came from Elizabeth Warren, with whom, Ms. Wood, you spoke for, Marketplace Tech a week or two ago. And as one does, one asks her the Make Me Smart question on the way out.
What is something I thought I knew? Oh, many, many years ago, when I first started studying families in bankruptcy, I thought I knew who filed for bankruptcy. I had come from a family that had been turned upside down financially, but my family had never filed for bankruptcy. So I figured, you know, the people who actually go into bankruptcy, they're probably trying to cheat the system, take advantage. And I started studying who actually filed and looking at their overall financial picture and what had happened to them And I discovered I was very, very wrong. People who filed for bankruptcy were folks who'd, you know, worked hard, gone to college, gotten married, bought a house, had kids, and then had just been turned upside down by a serious medical problem, a job loss, or a death or divorce in the family. The people who filed for bankruptcy weren't there because they were looking for some advantage. They weren't there because they were glad to be in the bankruptcy courts. They were there because they were flat out of options. And it was a big part of how I came to understand what was happening to America's once solid middle class. A middle class that was strong and robust. Families who worked hard, who played by the rules, and bigger numbers of them just fell by the wayside. So something I learned that I hadn't known before.
Yeah, that's that whole social stigma that goes with bankruptcy, which is really sort of a fascinating way to think about that.
Yeah, it is really interesting. You know? I read this is a going to sound like a insane, it's not really. Reddit, there was this great thing on Reddit. Somebody on Reddit dissected the story of Job in the Bible and essentially came to the conclusion that the entire story of Job is about not judging people who are poor because they did nothing to deserve it. Like, you remember Job was cursed for no reason.
Well, okay, yes, I remember.
It was just a wonderful interpretation. It was very similar to the Elizabeth Warren interpretation, which is like, it doesn't mean you are lesser,
right,
that you have nothing.
Right.
You know, you didn't necessarily do anything to deserve being born into a family of billionaires versus not. Anyway.
I need to go back and read my Bible. The Make Me Smart question is, what is something you thought you knew, but then you found out you were wrong about it? Think about it. Take as long as you like. And then record your answer. Email it to us on your phone, by the way, or wherever you like. And email it to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And we'll put it on the pod.
Yes. And thank you for listening. Please keep all the feedback coming. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends to subscribe and stick with us. Hey, we'll see you again on Thursday.
Yeah. I think that was a good idea.
I know.
Okay, you ready? So here goes. I promised. Here goes. Here you go. I'm going with the music. Here we go. Make Me Smart is produced by senior producer Eve Troe, Christopher Olin, and Sharon Morris. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski and Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed, I almost stuck to it too, by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. Got a little high
for
me.
Oh my God.
Got a little high.
You guys. I got nothing. The executive director of Vance's attorney, the CRS president, general manager, Christopher Clark.
If and when I ever leave Marketplace, my blooper reel, if and when, he says, my blooper reel is going to be hours long. Hours. Hours.
Yeah. Yep. Actually, no, it's not, because now it's just going to be just that.
Now it's just going to be that.
Just that. Turns out it is now. It has been shrunken to an amazing, amazing 20 seconds you have ever heard.
I should have started down here. Anyway, there we go. See you Thursday. Bye.
Bye.
Thursday, bye.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.